So we went Daf Lamed Aleph on the base.
Just the beginning of the page?
Or yeah. Yeah, very much on the beginning of the page. And the top line of the page is really the last discussion that we had yesterday, a very long and complicated discussion with a Chassam Sofer. And what we need to know as we go forward is that we have here a Shita of Rav Nachman, and according to Rav Nachman, in the case of a Shalish where the Malv and the Loved jointly, by joint agreement, they deposited the Shtar in the hands of a third party, and you and I would say that that third party should be believed to claim, let's say for example, that the shtar was already paid up and it's no longer viable in the hands of the malvin, because that person who is the third party, that's called a shlish, that person could actually destroy the shtar if they wanted to just mess up the malvin, so that we should believe to say it's parua. But Rav Nachman says that applies before Bezdin gets a hold of the shtar. Once Bezdin gets their hands on the shtar, which is called Dischazek Bebeit Dina, Gershon, you have the place on the top of Lamed Aleph Amid Beis.
Yes.
So you see those words, Dischazek Bebeit Dina, Bebeit Dina, those to the top line on Lamed Aleph Amid Beis.
You're not reading in the Gemara, you're reading in the Gemara, I'm looking at Lamed Aleph Amid Beis.
Oh, yeah,
I'm there.
Yeah, the top line. You see what it says, Dischazek Bebeit Dina?
Oh, yes.
So those were the last three words that we studied in depth yesterday.
Yes,
we had a long analysis of those three words. And it comes out that once Bezdin gets a hold of the shtar, so it's no longer in the hands of the shlish at this point.
Right.
And what they do is they investigate the shtar and they send out the word that we need people to come and authenticate the signatures on the shtar. And once they authenticate the signatures on the shtar, knowing that it's not a forgery, then they put what's called a henpeik on the shtar.
Yes.
And that's a signature of the seal and signature of the judges that this shtar is a valid shtar and it's authenticated. That's called kiyum shtaros. Mm-hmm. So once the shtar has a chazakah, meaning it's already been verified, and Bezdin on Mekayim the shtar, that itself makes it impossible for her to be believed. Why? Because
or not believed.
Because she's not going to be believed, because the once the shtar is out of the hands of the shlish, in this case it was a woman, and it's in the hands of Bezdin, then she no longer has what we call a migu. She can no longer destroy the shtar because Bezdin already has possession of the shtar. So now the Gemara is going to ask Akasha, Eisve, and that's on the second line.
Yes.
And the Kasha is being asked by Rava as an objection to Rav Nachman, because Rav Nachman was the one who said that once the shtar is in the hands of the Bezdin, we no longer believe the shlish, we no longer believe that third party, because there's no migu anymore. What kind of migu is it when there's already a henpeik on the shtar? And yesterday we had a long discussion about this, that once there's a henpeik on the shtar, Rashi identifies that as a maisa Bezdin. It's as if Bezdin has already issued their verdict, that we're not going to undermine the Maisa Bezdin, that the authority of Bezdin, by believing a migu. So Eisvei Ravel of Nachman, we have a brisa that speaks about a simpon. So let's take a few minutes to speak about a simpon. A simpon is otherwise known as a shovar, which in English would be something similar to a receipt. What happens is that after the lova, the borrower pays back the lender, he pays back the malva, he asks for some sort of a document that would attest to the fact that he paid up this loan. And that's called either a shovar in some cases, or here it's called a simpon. And once the lova has a simpon, then he's believed to say, I paid up the chov, because that's a simpon. That's actually, the word simpon has a more generic meaning to it. A simpon actually literally means anything that comes to cancel something else is called a simpon. So in this case, the receipt, the simpon, is coming to cancel the malva, the shtar milva, the shtar itself that testifies that he owes money. Now we have a simpon to cancel the import or the testimony of the shtar milva.
Who gave him the simpon?
The malva has to make sure that he gives the okay to two witnesses who actually witness the payment of the loan, and with the commissioning of the malva, the malva gives his agreement to the eidim to sign this shtar simpon and give it over to the lova. So the lova.
It's a separate shtar. I mean, you have the shtar for the malva, for the halva,
right.
And now
shtar simpon. Right?
Why don't they just rip up the original halva, but instead they have another shtar that they're producing for the purpose of
correct? It could be that, again. It's hard for us to imagine this, but back in the day, a shtar was a very expensive business. The cloth itself was on vellum. You had to pay a scribe to write the shtar. So you might theoretically want to have that shtar for future use. And that depends upon what's called nimchal shibudo, whether or not you could use the shtar a second time around. But imagine that the lova borrowed, now he was able to return the money, but he realizes that he might need to borrow some more money. So he might want to leave the shtar in the hands of the malva. Alternatively, it could be very possible that the lova is afraid that the shtar might fall and somehow get back into the hands of the malva. So he wants to guarantee that under all circumstances he has testimony or evidence that he paid back the shtar. So that's called a simpon. Now you may see a tosis here, divra maschil simpon. Let's see if we find such a tosis. Yeah, the second tosis down from the page. And tosis says that shover v'yotze mitachas yad lova kipshuto. In other words, the first pshat here before Rabbeinu Tam, which is based on Rashi, is that the lova is holding on to this simpon. That makes sense, correct? And perhaps before the malva actually gives over the simpon to the lova, that's when it's called a simpon. Once the simpon is handed from the malva to the lova, then it's called the shovar. So the simpon is—it's all the same document, but the simpon is in the potential. You know, it's been written, it's been signed and sealed, but it's not powerful. It's not active until it gets into the hands of the lova as proof. So then that transition is called shovar. Shovar means now it's in the hands of the lova. So as long as it's in the hands of the malva, it's called a simpon. Now the next two words in the brisa, simpon sheishal of edim, right? So the two signatures on the simpon, and the next two words in the brisa are yiskayim bechosma. Okay, so let's translate those. Those are important words. Yiskayim bechosma. What that means is that
it's actualized with their signature.
Correct. We invoke or we subpoena the two witnesses whose signatures appear on the shtar. We ask them, did in fact you sign the shtar? That's called Yiskayim Bechosmav. So the kium means to give sustenance and substance and validity to the shtar, is Bechosmav, with the same two witnesses that signed on the shtar, because they're going to recognize their signature. And they're going to attest to the fact that there's no ziyuf here, that there's no forgery. This is indeed their signature. And at that point, the simpon is kosher. We've interrogated the eidim who are signed on the shtar. They verify that they indeed signed on the shtar. And at that point, the lova is now believed to say that he paid up the chov because he has a valid simpon, a shtar, shover in his hands. Now, what I want to share with you here is a fascinating Gemara, not here, but in Bava Metzia. The Gemara says in Bava Metzia that it's not enough to ask the two witnesses if they signed on the shtar, meaning can they recognize their signature, but we have to go beyond that. We have to ask them, do you remember that you saw this loan being paid up? That's a major difference, because if the Edim could not remember, they cannot testify to the fact that they remember that this chov was paid up, then the Malva would be believed to say that it was never paid up, because the Malva still is holding on to the Shtar Milva. So let me just read to you a summary of the Gemara in Bav Metzia. The Gemara in Bav Metzia says, Yiskayim b'chosmav, sholim es ha'edim ha'chasumim al ha'simpon, ha'im ro es ha'piron olo. We ask the two witnesses that are signed, did you witness the payment of the loan? Vim lo, and if they don't have a positive answer, neman amal v'lo mishlo nifracho. Then again, it's a radical sugya, which you have to. We're not learning Bav Metzia, but if we were learning Bav Metzia, and then v'nichtav asimpon. So why did you sign this? Why did you sign this simpon if you didn't witness the halva?
Right.
I'm sorry, the piron. So the Edom give an answer, and by the way, it's not a flimsy answer, it's a really good answer, and they say that we only signed to prepare the shtar, and we gave it back to the Malva, allowing the Malva to decide if and when he will pass on the shtar to the Lova. And the Malva is now saying, well, I never actually passed on the shtar to the Lova. Now for this, again, we could have a long discussion about this, but just to sort of simplify it, if we can, every shtar is written in a way that it's written in first person of the mischayev. Okay, then again, that's a word I would have to write down on the board. In modern Hebrew, you'd say mitchayev. Okay? Where I come from, we called it a mischayev. But it means the same thing. The one who stands to lose as a result of the shtar is the one who, in quotation marks, writes the shtar. I don't mean that he physically writes the shtar, but the shtar is written in first person by the one who stands to lose from the shtar. In the case of a simpon, it's the malva. In the case of halva, it's the lova, because the lova writes here that I borrowed money from so and so. Now, in the case of a sale, the mischayev is the mocher, because he's giving up on his, let's call it karka, let's say on a piece of real estate. Now, in all these cases, the mischayev commissions two witnesses to sign on the shtar, and he, the mischayev, gets hold of the shtar. At this point, the shtar is neutral, it has no power. What activates the shtar? That's when the mischayev hands over the shtar to the person to whom he's going to be chayev. So what happens is, okay, let's see, I'm going to test you. In the case of a shtar halva, who writes the shtar?
The lova.
When is the shtar active? When does it become testimony? When the lova hands the shtar over to the malva. In the case of a simpon, who writes the shtar?
The malva.
The malva. When does it activate it?
When
the malva gives the shtar over to the lova. In the case of a shtar mecher, if I sell property, who writes the shtar, the mocher, the lokeach? The mocher. When is it activated? When the mocher hands over the shtar to the lokeach.
Like,
and again, I can give you other examples, but you get the basic principle.
It's the same as a kinyan.
I don't think it's a kinyan necessarily. It might be a shtar raya. It could be the kinyan was effectuated with chazaka, with kesef, whatever it is. But as a raya, as a proof, the shtar has to be written by the mischayev. He gets the edim to sign. He has it stashed away in his drawer. When the time comes, i.e. when the sale comes about or the payment of alva, at that point he pulls the shtar out of the drawer and hands it over
so,
to the other
what
person.
What are the witnesses witnessing? The witnessing
signature of the witness?
No, they're only witnessing the schaivus.
Well, the
the hit chai
vut. So they're actually saying to hand over the money. They're saying the money being handed over.
Well, again, you're a step ahead of me. But again, if you ask me in abstract terms, then we'll get back to this Gemara Bav Metzia.
Yeah.
The Edom see nothing.
Right.
Wow. So it's like signing a blank check.
I don't know if it's a blank check, but it's a check that will be activated when the Mischayev decides to give it over to the other person. But the Edom are not even there.
But they got to be witnesses or something. Otherwise, they're not
witnesses on the Hischayevus.
Hischayevus is
okay.
A potential Hischayevus.
Okay.
Yeah. A future Hischayevus.
Right. It's a conditional Hischayevus. Yeah. But what they're testifying that this person told us to write the Shtar. And he told us to write on a Shtar that I borrowed money from so-and-so. Did he actually borrow the money? Not yet. But when he borrows the money, he pulls out the shtar, hands over the shtar, in this case to the lender, to the malveh, and at that point the shtar is activated.
So what do the witnesses now testify to in court? All they can testify to is that he told me to write the shtar.
That's what I want to tell you about a simpon.
That's why they're
saying. That the Gemara in Bava Metzia, listen carefully, the Gemara in Bava Metzia is talking about the following case, that the simpon has been prepared by the edim, commissioned by the malveh. It's been prepared, and now the word preparation means that the malveh is holding on to the shtar. He will only activate that shtar, give it validity, if and when the lover pays him up. And at that point, the malveh will say, we'll make a swap. You give me the 1,000 that you owe me, I'll give you the simpon. Now, our case here is where the lover is not holding on to the simpon. Again, who's holding on to the simpon is unclear. It's either malva or a shlish. We're going to talk about a shlish. But the lover is not holding on to the simpon. If the lover was holding on to the simpon, we would not ask the edim, did they see the actual piron? Because the shtar testifies to the piron. And I don't care one way or the other whether they saw the piron. That's irrelevant, because the malva gave the shtar simpon over to the lover. The lover's holding on to the shtar. However, if the malva is holding on to the shtar, let's take that case, then we're going to have to ask the edim, did you see the piron? Because as long as the malva is holding on to the shtar is not valid testimony, right? Because again, the shtar is only a testimony that the malva commissioned us to write the shtar, but who knows if the lov ever paid up.
Yeah, that's the problem.
If the lov is holding on to the shtar, then we believe that he paid up. Why do we believe that he paid up? Because how did he get the shtar? The malva gave him the shtar. But if the malva is still holding on to the shtar, then the edim would have to go a step further, and they would have to testify that we signed on this simpon after we saw the piron. Alright, this is just for your own edification. If we were learning about Metzia, we would have a lot of fun with this.
But here's where I'm lost. The witnesses never really witnessed a loan being made or paid back or anything. All they witnessed was, hey, there's this document. I signed the document that this guy prepared the document.
Correct.
I don't know anything about the loan.
That's the beauty of shtar.
Well, it's not a beauty, isn't it a deficiency?
I think it's the beauty of shtar, because what's unique about shtar is that everything depends upon who's holding on to the shtar. The possession of the shtar, I'll give you an example. Let's say you have a promissory note that somebody owes you money. What gives validity and the legal gishpanka, you know, to that promissory note is the fact that you're holding on to the note. Because we don't assume that you found it. We don't assume that you climbed up to the heavens and you got it down from the heavens. We don't assume you stole it. You stealthily went in. It means if you have it, the Mischayev must have given it over to you. You may remember that yesterday, I don't know if you remember this, we spoke about Osios Niknos B'Mesira. Does that ring any bell? It should be the last line on Lamed Amid Beis. Let's turn to Lamed again. I don't know. I'm very eager to move on, but let's. Do you see Amalei Ravler of Nachman? It's two lines up before the end of Lamed Aleph Amid Aleph. Kirebi. Do you see that Kiman Kirebi? Do you have such a thing? Yes, no, maybe. Kiman Kirebi.
Can't go back.
Oh yeah, it's not easy to go back. Oh, so listen, Balpe, you don't even have to turn. Don't even bother.
I can get to it. Lamed
Aleph Amid Aleph. This, I'm going back to yesterday.
Lamed
Aleph, 31A, on the bottom, two lines up from the bottom. This we did yesterday. I'm just trying to jolt your memory. And he says, Keman Kerebi Diomar Osios Niknos B'Mesira. Osios Niknos B'Mesira. You have those three words?
Yep.
Okay, so let me explain what those three words is. I'm just repeating what I said yesterday. Because sometimes we have to remember. What, you know, we need reminding, do we not? It happens. I mean, we all have to do chazar, right? So just to give you a quick chazar, I own a loan, so to speak, meaning you owe me a loan. I want to sell that loan on the open market. The buyer is going to pay me, I always tend to use the example of a bond, right? How much do you pay for a bond? You know, discount. It's a slashed price, right? Because the money is futuristic money. You know, the bond will mature in 7 years. I don't know what it is today. 10 years, whatever it is. So you pay whatever you pay. Now you need proof that you bought the chov. So, Don, you lent me money, and now I owe you money. You want to sell that to Bob. What proof does he have? Says Rebbe, you just hand over the shtar to him. Now wait a second. Bob comes into Beis Din and he wants to collect 1,000 from me. So Beis Din says, where's your proof? Because I'm going to deny the whole story. So Bob says, I have a shtar. Very interesting. Whose name is mentioned in the shtar? Don's name is mentioned in the shtar. Bob's name... What are you doing here in Beis Din? Get the heck out of here. I don't recognize you. Your name is not in the shtar. Says Rebbe, Osios Niknos B'Mesira. Mesira means the very moment that you, Don, pass over the shtar. Mesira Limsar, right? To hand over, to trap. Bob becomes the owner of the shtar. Pili Plan. The beauty of a shtar is that a shtar goes way beyond the words that are written in the shtar, and everything depends on who's holding on to the shtar.
You would think that you should put Adam on.
So that's what the Chachamim say. The Chachamim say we're going to have to add Bob's name to the shtar. But Rebbe says it's not necessary, because Rebbe says that all of shtar depends upon tfisa, upon holding on to the shtar. If you're holding on to the shtar, the shtar will tell me anything I want to know. I'll give you another example. Here I'll tell you Pili Ploy. The Gemara seems to assume that if the Lova commissions the writing of the shtar, he doesn't even have to write in the shtar the name of the Malva. It's blank.
I owe
no name.
Right.
And the Malva comes with the shtar, and we believe him. Why? Because he's holding on to the shtar. His name is not even in the shtar. That's the beauty of shtars.
There used to be something, no one does it anymore that I know of, bearer bonds, which there was no names on it. It was a document which said that the holder of this
bond is entitled
to $50,000 or $100,000, and whoever held it was entitled to the money.
That's the way it works in the whole world.
Right.
But at least according to Rebbe.
I mean, most of the problems we're discussing, it's hardly if at all anymore, right? Because now you want names and, you know, bonds.
Right, today everything is, you know, everything is computerized, it's digital. But in those days, everything depended upon what's called tfisas bala shtar, the holding on to the shtar. In Bav Metzia, there are all sorts of cases about a shtar that fell, and somebody picked it up, or we don't know who picked it up, did he have a right to pick it up, you know, the whole sugyas about that. But they're all based on this premise that shtar is activated by the one who's holding on to the shtar. So again, the simpot is in the hands of the malve. When the malve gets paid up, he hands over the simpot to the lova. The lova now is holding on to a shova. But if we're talking about a simpot, which means it's in the hands of the malve, then if the Eidim want to testify, we're going to interrogate them. Hey, you're signed on this shtar. Did you see the halt? Did you see the piron? Did you see him pay up? So the Gemara says, if the Eidim say we didn't see him pay up, the whole thing is worthless, because the Malva is holding on to the simpon. If it's a shovar, which means the Lova is holding on to it, we don't have to ask the Eidim. I couldn't give two hoots whether the Eidim know whether they saw the piron, they didn't see the piron, because the Lova is holding on to the shtar. And the tfisas bala shtar means that the shtar will testify on behalf of he who is tofes the shtar.
Yeah,
That's just a little bit of a, like, the tip of the iceberg of Staros. Staros is one of the most complicated sugyas. I mean, in my mechutin has a kolel for Choshen Mishpat. They spend I don't know how many years studying Staros. I mean, it's so complicated. I mean, I just gave you like a, you know, from the top surface, you know, peel the top layer, as we would say. I didn't even peel it. All right. Then it says the following. So, did the Lover write this simpon as a forgery? Forging? How do you say it? Two signatures? No. Why? Because the Adam that is signed on the simpon are right here in front of us, and they attest to the fact that this is their signature. Okay. Now, what happens if ain't a love Adam? Could you imagine? It says that I, so-and-so, paid back the loan to so-and-so. No witnesses. What would you say to that? Is it worth a dime? Throw it in the head of the British court, in the rubbish bin, right?
It's worth the paper it was written on.
Worth the paper, no, nothing more than that. Ah, now I have a finish for you. The Brisa says, Yotza mitachas yad shlish.
Ah.
Here's an interesting case.
He's got a vouch for it.
The Malve and the Love agreed to deposit this shtar, this simpon, in the hands of a third party. We could call it escrow, I don't know what you want to call it. In Hebrew it's called a shlish, shalish. Okay, both the Malva and the Lova admit that they appointed this shlish to hold on to the simpon.
But there's still, his name is not on it, and he's just a credible person apparently.
Correct. And again, what gives him credibility? It's the fact that nobody denies that the shtar was deposited in his possession. Oh. Now again, I'm just going to fast forward for a second. We'll come back to the old kosher. Do you see the word kosher? Kosher means that the simpon is valid. Why? After all, there are no signatures on the simpon. But the answer is because it's being held and in the hands of the shlish. Here's another case. Oh, I'm going backwards. Sheyotza achar chitum shtaros. It means the following. That you have a shtar milva, which says that so-and-so borrowed such and such amount of money from so-and-so. And on the shtar itself, which is now in the hands of the malva, underneath the signatures of the Edom, they write the following words. The above shtar has been paid up. Now, it's a little bit complicated because, generally speaking, a shtar begins with wherever it begins and it ends with the chasimas ha'edim. You can draw pictures underneath, you know, if you're your doodles, you know, but it's
meaningless.
It's not part of the shtar. But here, and this is the chiddush of the Braisa, that even though this additional writing was added below the signatures, but nevertheless, the Malva would not have allowed that to happen unless it actually happened. So the very fact that the Shtar Milva, which now the Malva is producing, it has a postscript in which it says this Shtar was paid up, that's enough of a testimony, even though there are no signatures on that part of the simpon. You follow? It's like, have you ever seen a document which has the dotted lines in the bottom? You know, it says the above is for office use or something like that, right? So below the dotted lines, it says the above document was paid up. And you and I would say, well, are there any signatures below the dotted line? There are no signatures. The only two signatures on the shtar testify that the shtar, that the halva is outstanding, that he owes him the loan. But the answer is that the Malva would never allow anyone to tamper with his shtar and write on it the above shtar was paid. You know, like, you ever see though, they have these stamps, you know, they... Okay. So what does Rava want to gain from this whole discussion here from the Braisa? And that's where we start with the word Alma. You have the word Alma?
Yeah.
Alma... We see from this that Shalish Mehemon, right? The Brisa says that if the shtar is the simpon is in the hands of what? Of a shlish, he's believed the shtar is kosher, and he's going to claim that it was paid up. That's what the Simpon says. Now wait a second. Does the shlish have a migu? He doesn't have a migu. Because this shtar, this Simpon, is in the hands of Bezdin. How do I know it's in the hands of Bezdin? Because the Brisa says Yiskayim v'chosvav. Yiskayim v'chosvav means that the judges will investigate the signatures and verify them, authenticate them. So who's holding on to the shtar now? It must be Bezdin. And yet, even though it's Huchzak B'yad Bezdin, the Shlish is believed. Tyuvta Rav Nachman Tyuvta. We see that Rav Nachman is upshloved. Why? Because the Brisa testifies to the fact that we believe the Shlish, even though the Shtar Simpon is in the hands of Bezdin. Rav Nachman didn't want to believe the Shlish. Why didn't he want to believe the Shlish? Because it's Chazik B'Beit Dina, the first three words on the page. That means that Bezdin already saw the Shtar, and she doesn't have a Migu, the Shlish doesn't have a Migu, that they could have destroyed it because it's already in the hands of Bezdin. And yet the Brisa says that this Shtar is kosher. And why? Because it was in the hands of a Shlish. And now the Shlish is saying that it was paid up. Wait a minute. But it's no longer in the hands of the Shlish. It's already in the hands of Bezdin. Doesn't matter. Before she gave the Simpon over to Bezdin, she had the Simpon. And once she has the Simpon, she's believed. That's the nemonis, that's the credibility or the status of a Shlish.
But there's a difference here.
Yeah.
In the first case, we're talking about a Simpon, a Shlish who comes into court, and the court has the shtar, which is evidence of the loan from the halva to the milga, all right? And the Shlish is saying, no, it's been paid.
Right.
And so the ruling, Rav Nachman says, we don't believe the Shlish because we have the document attesting to the loan and there's no contradiction. We don't accept the word of the Shlish, all right?
Right.
But in this case, it's the opposite, because in this case, What is the Shlish attesting to? It's attesting to the Simpon, which is evidence that the loan has been repaid. And she's saying, and it's handed into the court, and the court now has a valid Simpon, which now is a shovar, right?
Right.
Right. That says it's been repaid. And she's coming in and agreeing to what's there. Previously, she was
contradicting.
She was contradicting the document. In this case, she's agreeing with the document. So of course you accept it.
Right, but the only thing is there are no signatures on the document. So what leg does
But it's two different things.
No, I see what you're saying, but what leg does the lover have to stand on that this Simpon is valid testimony when there are no edim on the Simpon? The only leg that he has to stand on is the testimony of the Shlish. But Rav Nachman says the testimony of the Shlish is contingent on the fact that the Shlish is holding on to the shtar. Here's a case where the Shlish is not holding on to the shtar, and yet we're going to believe the Shlish. Do you follow? We're going to validate the testimony in this Simpon, in this Shovar, based on the word of the Shlish. There are no edim signed on the shtar. And why? Because you're a Shlish. Okay, you're a Shlish, but what migu do you have? The answer is, forget about migu. Yesterday I had a migu. But what I have is the fact that both the Malva and the Lova agreed to give me the Simpon. And that already appoints me as a Shalish. And once I get that appointment as a Shalish, Bezdin will listen to what I have to say. They'll rely on my testimony vis-a-vis the Shtar. Okay.
So she's a substitute for the witnesses.
Correct.
Whereas in the first case, we're talking about the shtar itself, which is evidence of the loan, right? She's contradicting it. So again, I'm back, because she's in place of the witnesses in both cases, the only difference is in one case she's contradicting the document, in the other case she's agreeing with the document.
Right, but in both cases she has the power to testify about the document. In other words, whether the document will be effective or not depends on her word. even after the document is already in the hands of the
bank. I hear that, and I'm still saying that the only I'm a new guy here, you know.
No,
but it doesn't make any, the only reason it makes any sense to me is because she's agreeing with it. Everything you said is 100% correct. But I can see in the first case of Rav Nachman, she's contradicting the document, and we refuse to allow her to contradict the document because the document has already been shtut by the court,
right?
We believe the witnesses, everything, where she can't now come in and give contradictory evidence. Yeah, right. She had it yesterday, right? But in the case of the Simfon, which is now a shavar because it's also been stumped by the court, right? She's saying, yeah, this is a valid document. I had it. The loan was repaid. I know the two guys, whatever it is. And I agree with, so she's agreeing with the document. When the other case, she's
disagreeing. Let's look at it this way, Don. The Malva has a shtar in his hands.
Okay.
As long as the Malva shtar is valid, Lolov has to pay up the chol.
Right.
Those are the rules of the game.
Understood.
Comes along a shlish and says, you know what? The loan was paid up. Why should we believe the shlish? Basically, the shlish is invalidating the shtar milveh of the malveh.
If I was assuming she has it in her hands, right? In both cases.
Well, she once had it in her hands.
She once had it in her hands.
But I'm just saying that in the total picture of it, the shlish is coming to undermine, or shall we say, to disqualify the validity, right, of the shtar milveh. Now, a shtar milveh is really a very powerful document. It's like money in the bag, you know, in the bank. And now she comes and says, forget about the shtar milveh, it was paid on.
So what if she...
Why?
But presumably she handed it into the court so that the court could approve it, right? She had it in her hand. How did the court get it? Presumably she handed it over. Would it be a different story if she comes into the court? Because we're talking...
I don't know. That's an excellent question.
Right.
I thought it was
because
the same question myself.
Time differences. This whole idea is that there's already been a verdict, and now someone's coming in afterwards and contradicting what the court already has said, right? So if she comes in with, say, 30... The court gives 30 days. She comes in within 30 days and says, listen, it was stolen from my house, but I can attest to the fact that he paid it, and I intended to rip it up and burn it, and I just have a chance. In the meantime, someone came into my house and stole it, but I can attest to that. That's a different story.
Okay. You're asking good questions. Let's see if we can make a little progress. Ki asa Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. Omar, he says in the name of Rav Yochan. Rav Yochan was the giant in Eretz Yisrael. Li olam mevi raya v'soser Ashi's Tatem Tanosov. Do you remember we discussed the issue? Up to what point can the defendant bring in evidence? Says Rabbi Yochanan, we have a very open door policy. We're going to allow the litigant, in this case, let's call it the defendant, to come in and say, well, I have a proof. And even though the judges had already handed down a verdict, soser es dino. Soser es dino means they will completely renege or nullify their original psak din. Achi statem tanosov. Until the lover, the defendant, finally makes a statement, I don't have any more testimony. Up until that point, he can come in and say, you know, your judgment was incorrect. I finally got my act together. I found these witnesses. I found the shtar. I have evidence. He's allowed to do so. Now, after the point of Yistatem Tanosov, in the first case here that we're dealing with, we're going to have a second case in just a second, the lover, the defendant, no longer has rights to bring in evidence because the lover already, in this first case, the lover said, I don't have any evidence. Now we have a second case. Yomar, the Yomar, now here the Vav means or as a second alternative, Kirvu Ploni Uploni Veheiduni. What happens now? We're at the end, the very final stage of the judgment. The judges are about to issue their official verdict against the Lova, against the defendant. And the defendant says, oh, you see those two guys in the audience here, you know, sitting in the courtroom? Tell them to come in. Tell them to come forward. And let them testify on my behalf. Once again, Beis Din says, that's a no-go. So the Gemara says, Gufa ha gufa kasha. There's a contradiction here in the words of Rabbi Yochanan from what we call the Reisha to the Sefer. Why? Because in the Reisha, it says, Amrit, it says, Ad she yistatem tanosav, which means that until the Lova says, I have no testimony, he can always bring in testimony. Asan l'rabbanan. The Rabbanan are of the opinion that when a person says, I have no testimony, he can no longer bring in testimony. If you recall, again, just to refresh your memories, that Rav Shimon Gamliel disagrees, and he says that even though the defendant admitted that he has no evidence, but maybe all of a sudden he found evidence. But from the language of Rabbi Yochanan, Achistatim Tanosov, you see clearly that once he admits that he has no evidence, he can no longer bring in evidence. And that's the sheet of the Rabbanon. The Hadar Amrit, and then you went back and you told me, Rabbi Yochanan, in the Sefer, the last part, Achi Yomar Kirvu Ish Ploni Ploni Veiduni. At what point does the Lovel lose his rights to bring in evidence? When he makes this declaration, let these two fellows who are sitting in the back of the court, let them invite them forward to give their aids. That it means, just one second. Oh, Asan Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was the one who said that even if the defendant said he had no witnesses, he still believed to bring in witnesses. Unless he says, when he sees it's the end, you know, what is it, the hammer is about to go down, he says, let these guys come in and testify. That's a case where even Rav Shimon Gamliel agrees that something's fishy over here. He must have been paying off these witnesses, and when he saw that he has no choice, he's less bravery, he has no option, and they're about to pass that he has to pay the $1 million, then he says, okay guys, he winks at them, remember I paid you whatever I paid you to perjure yourselves. So in that case, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel admits. But what's unclear over here, and there's a contradiction here between the Reish and the Seif of Rabbi Yochanan, is what happens in the case where the Lova says, I have no further evidence. I don't have any evidence. And then he brings in evidence.
So why couldn't it just mean that I have no further evidence at this time?
So again, that would be Rav Shimon Gamliel. Rav Shimon Gamliel would say that what he meant was, at this time I have no evidence. Now he's allowed to bring it, unless this fishy thing comes up, you know, where just as at the last minute, the 11th hour, then he says, oh, I have... these guys are here sitting in that's fishy already. But otherwise, if he just says, I have no evidence, it means at this time I have no evidence. That's Rav Shimon Gamliel. But if you look at Rabbi Yochanan, he said, Achi is tatein tanosav, which is the same thing as saying, he declares I have no evidence. That's not Rav Shimon Gamliel. Right? Rav Shimon Gamliel holds that even after he declares he has no evidence, he's believed to say he has evidence, and will trust his evidence. So apparently Rabbi Yochanan is accepting the Chachamim. The Chachamim have this absolute rule that if the defendant says, I have no more evidence, that's it, finito. He's closed the door. Okay, so Rabbi Yochanan accepted the Rabbanan. That's fine. But then he says, Yomar kirvu ploni ploni veiduni. That's Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says that at what point does the Lova close the door, what word do I want to use? Does he make it impossible or block the possibility of bringing evidence? It's only in this case where he says, Yavo ploni uploni. So who are you holding like, Rabbi Yochanan? Did you accept the Rabbanon? And immediately when he says, I have no evidence, that's it, closed case, finito, no backs? Or do you accept Rav Shimon Gamliel that the only case where the lover forfeits his rights to bring in evidence is this last case of Kirvu Ish Ploni Uploni Ve'iduni? Where does Rav Yochanan stand? Where is he? What's he holding? V'chitei, you could say, Kula Rav Shimon Gamliel, he accepts Rav Shimon Gamliel from head to toe, from A to Z, Uperushi Koma Farish. And all Rabbi Yochanan did in the Sefer was he was explaining the Reisha. What did I mean, my, when I said Ashi Statin Tanosov, that he closed himself off? And he said, I have no more proof. It means Ashi Yomar Kirvu Ploni Uploni Veiduni. Until that very last case where we don't believe him. That can't be so. V'omar Rabba Barachon Rabbi Yochanan Kol Mokum Sheshon Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Mishnah Seinu Halacha Kemoso. Chutz me orev v'tzaydan urayach rona. It means that there's one of three cases where we don't accept Rav Shimon Gamliel, and that case is the case of rayach rona, which means when Rav Shimon Gamliel validates testimony and evidence even after the din, we don't accept it. Why? Because the defendant has already made a statement that I have no more evidence. So in this case, Rav Shimon Gamliel says he can bring in more evidence, and the Rabbanan say, can't bring in any more evidence. And Rav Yochanan Paskins like the Chachamim against Rav Shimon Gamliel. It's one of the three exceptions to the rule where we reject Rav Shimon Gamliel. So it means that Rav Yochanan accepted Halacha that once the defendant made the statement, I have no more testimony, that's it. So you can't say Purushe Kama Farish, that when Rabbi Yochanan said Achis Tatin Tanosov, he meant in this very specific case of Kiru Plodi Uploni Ve'iduni. Eloki also Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda, we had to wait. Now this was Rav Dimi. Now somebody by the name of Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda comes from Eretz Yisrael, and he's going to clarify what Rav Yochanan had in mind. Amar Rav Yochanan, he says, this is what I heard from Rav Yochanan. Li'ola mevi raya v'soser. He can always bring proof and undermine the judgment. Achis tatem ta'nosav v'yomru lo have edim v'omer ein li edim. Havi Raya V'Yomer Ein Li Raya. Okay, so far this is the Rabbanan Shita. That's good. Aval Bo Edim Mimedina Sayam Oshahoysa Diskia Shel Aviv Mufkedes Biyad Acher Hareze Mevi Raya. Rabbi Yochanan says that there are two exceptional cases. And in these two exceptional cases, we honestly believe that when the defendant said, Ein li raya, ein li edim, he was mistaken. It was an honest-to-goodness mistake. What were the two cases? Bo edim v'dina sayam. Two witnesses showed up from
overseas.
Overseas, from very far away. There was no way that he could anticipate that they would be here and they could offer testimony on his behalf. Or, what happened is, his father left an entire bag, that's called a diskia, a leather bag, a leather pouch, that was full of different documents, monetary documents. Mufkedes biyad acher, and the father during his lifetime had deposited this diskia, this bag of documents, this folder, I guess you'd call it, in the hands of somebody else. And now this guy comes forward and he says, look, I found a document in this bag.
Right.
There was no way that the children could know about this document because it was in the hands of someone else. They didn't have access to it. It's in those cases, I raise them, mevi raya. These are cases with Sosa where even the Chachamim would agree that there's ample proof that he did not know about this raya. That the defendant, when he made that statement, Ainli raya, Ainli, what was the other language? Ainli edim. He didn't know about this raya. In such a case, we can introduce the new evidence and reopen the case. And that's something that even the Chachamim would agree to. You may recall, again, I'm just trying to jolt your memory, that we had a case like that with Yesomim, with orphans that we had in the Gemara above, and we believe them to say we didn't, you know, we had no clue that there was such evidence. Now, the only thing that confuses me here is, according to this transmission, do we have the words Kirvu Ish Ploni Uploni? I mean, those are the words that gave us a little bit of a headache over here. The Ola may be Raya of Associate Sayyam. So he never actually adds the case of Kir. I guess he's just erasing that from the transmission. That's my impression.
Unless they happen to be the guys who arrived from overseas. If the Ploni and Ploni were the people who arrived from overseas here.
And what? Yes. Why didn't he? And he should have known about it. You mean?
Yeah.
And why did he? Why did he say I don't have any proof? If they were there in the courtroom, is that what you mean?
Maybe they just got. He, you know, he's sitting there, and all of a sudden somebody runs in like they do in the detective shows and say, these two guys just arrived from overseas.
Right. So in that case, I think if all of a sudden these two gentlemen arrive from overseas, then I think we should invite them to testify. There was no way that he would have known that these two Joes would show up from overseas.
Yeah.
But I'm just pointing out that I don't know. I don't have. I don't see a note here. Let me just see. Maybe. Oh wait a minute. There's this give me a moment. Just one second. I don't see that he's bothered by my question. What happened to? What happened to this case of? Right, Kirvu Ish Ploni Ploni Veiduni. Where did they get lost in the shuffle?
You want to hear that formula. You want to hear that is...
Maybe that wasn't part of the formula. I mean, somebody should point out that they were changing the formula by omitting that piece here. I don't know. Do you have any footnotes? Or you guys are working on computers here. You don't have any physical book.
No, but this footnotes.
His declaration that he has no one else does not prevent him from presenting the two guys from overseas.
Right. But does anybody make a comment on the words Kirvu Ish Ploni Ploni Veiduni? Any of your notes over there? Because I don't find a note on that.
Nope.
I would be more comfortable if somebody just point out that according to this version, Rabbi Yochanan never added that comment. Because if he did add that comment, it's a little bit out of place over here. It's like a fish out of water kind of thing. Okay. Let's come on. Now, we're opening up a brand new sugya. Now, let me just ask you for your intuition. If I were to ask you what your moral compass, you know, your natural moral compass. Supposing the Malva and the Lova are in disagreement about which Beis Din to go to. Like there are higher courts that are, you know, made up of experts, but they may be far away, so it's a big schlep. Who do you think, in the case of a Malvin Alova, would have the right to make the final decision, this is where we're going for judgment? Is it the Malva or the Lova? Like the Lova says, let's have the judgment locally. And the Malva says, no, I want to go to the real experts that, you know, let's go all the way up to Yerushalayim or something. Well, the other way around. Let's say the Malva says, let's judge it locally. The Lova says, let's take it all the way up to the High Court in Yerushalayim and we're going to pay all the donkey riders and everything, take the schlep, both directions, up and down.
I would assume the Malva.
The Malva can make the decision?
That's what I'm assuming.
But the Malva is the one who's suing.
Ah.
Right? Because the Malva is saying, you owe me. Yeah, I mean, we have no...
Okay.
You know, the Lova goes...
Modus on the Lova. Let's talk about Modus on the Lova.
Yeah.
No, the Lova
goes...
The Lova is defending, right?
Yeah.
So the Lova should have the right to say where he wants to be litigated.
Yeah.
I would say the opposite.
So let's see the Gemara inside. That's unfortunately, there are a lot of words here in the Gemara that are very difficult. So I'm going to try to do the best I can. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Hatokev es chaveru bidin. Now, I'm not sure why exactly he uses the word tokev. Tokev means I schlep you, I grab you, I seize you. You know, it's indicative of a certain kind of aggression, almost. He's a tough guy, you know. And he comes to claim against you, you owe me money. The Echen Omer, one of the two, says, Nadun Kan. Let's judge locally. You know, we have a good court system here in our hometown. The Echad Omer, and the other one says, Nelech Lemokom HaVad. Okay, what is Vad means? A gathering, so to speak, or a, you know, we have a group together, a council that's called a Vad. So the word Vad here in this particular context means a higher court that's made up of many scholars. You know, it could be the local guys. You know, they may be intelligent and they're, you know, upstanding citizens, but they're not necessarily Talmidei Chachamim. So one of the two, the Malva, the Lova, is willing to judge here locally. I don't want to schlep. And the other one says, no, I want a better, more reliable court of experts. I want to go to the Makom HaVad.
Kofinoto.
So these words, Kofinoto, will only make sense if we go back to the words Echad V'Echad. So let's start with Echad V'Echad before we get to Kofinoto. So the first Echad, Rashi identifies as the Malva. The Malva says, you know what? Let's judge locally. Let's go to the local court. So the Echad, and the second one is the Lova. So the Lova says, I want to get a fair decision, and therefore I want to go to the Beis Havad, to the Mokom Havad. Is Kofinoso the Yelech le Mokom Havad? So if my interpretation is correct, then who has the ultimate, I don't know if you call it veto power, the Lova, correct. Because the Lova says, I don't want to be judged locally. You know what? I want to go to a greater time. Now I think what's happening here, again, this is just Berzon talking, is the following. You know, a Jew is shall I say, trustworthy to some extent. You know, he's not a swindler. But on the other hand, you know, if he feels he can get away with something, you know, without paying too much of a price for it, so you have a litigation over here. The Lova is saying to the Malva, I mean, not in these words, but I think the sort of like the subliminal message is that, you know, in this court, you're not embarrassed to come up with sort of false claims, but I'm going to take you to the court of, you know, the Supreme Court of Israel, where the great scholars are sitting there. You're going to be booshed out. You're going to be embarrassed if you try to pull some. I want to know that you will be totally honest about your claims, because you realize that, you know, your reputation is at stake, and there are experts here that are going to investigate you, and they're going to find out that you're lying or something like that. I want to go to the top court. And this, in American law, I think it's called appeal. Uh-huh. In other words, again, this is not technically an appeal because we're talking about the first judgment, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, I could imagine that in any court system, there are higher courts and lower courts, and the issue is going to be who finally makes that decision. So it's really interesting because in this context, what could happen is, this is what I see as the failure, so to speak, of the system, is that the Malva, you know, sends a notice to the Lova that he has to appear in front of a court. The Lova could basically, what should I say, ignore that notice. I'm not going to the court. You want to take me to the court? You subpoena me to the High Court of Israel, you feel what I'm saying? Now, if everybody does that, you can imagine the backlog up there in Yerushalayim. I'm just giving an example. I don't know, I'm not saying that the Makom HaVad has to be Yerushalayim.
And by the way, in America, they do they have a lot of discussion about where you want to have the case, under what jurisdiction, where, you know, and the defendant or the prosecutor will determine you know, where they'll get a fair trial. So it's a similar idea.
Right.
It may not.
But I'm saying, I think what we're seeing until this point. Again, I'm not sure about the next line of the Gemara, but at this point, if you freeze the frame, what we're seeing is that the lov is really in the driver's seat over here, and it doesn't have to be the lov. It could be anyone who's a defendant, and the defendant has a right to say, "You're the plaintiff. You have to come with me to." And could you imagine? Imagine the expenses of a travel in two directions back in the day. You know, it's not like today. You get on a train, you're in Tel Aviv, you know, in a half hour. I don't know how long it takes, an hour. Not only that, it could be the trial will schlep along, which may mean that you'll have to take a hotel room. You know, at some point, the malva is going to say, you know, leave out this headache. It's not even worth it. In terms of the loan, the expenses I'm going to have to pay to squeeze you to get the money out of you so I get my money back are going to be greater than the loan itself.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just trying to show you the failures in the system. You understand what I mean? The challenges of the suit. Omar Lefanov. So remember that Rav Dimi came with this statement in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, and now Rabbi Elazar comes, you know, front stage. And Omar Lefanov, Rabbi Elazar. Now, I'm not sure, I think this is all part of the story that Rav Dimi is telling us. Now, he's telling us that back in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Yochanan made the following statement, and he evoked a response from Rabbi Elazar, who's the excellent, outstanding disciple of Rabbi Yochanan. And all this is being transmitted by Rav Dimi when he comes to Bava. So what did Rabbi Eliezer say to his Rebbe, Rabbi Yochanan? He said to him, Rebbe, Misha Noshe Bechavero Mona, Yotzi Mona Al Mona? The guy owes him a mona, and now he's going to have to spend a mona to schlep all the way to the Vad. It's just not worth it. But rather, Ela Kofen Oso Vidon V'Iro. And now Kofen Oso doesn't mean we force the Malva, it means we force the Lova to take the local judges and rely on them. Because otherwise, this is an ad infinitum, this is a ridiculous, ludicrous setup in which the Malva, who lent money, wants to get his money back. He's going to have to spend the same amount of money or more to get his money back. You can't do that.
But did we determine in the case of Rav Dimi that it's the
again, Rav Dimi is sort of like a cameraman. You know, he's a video. What would he call it? A videotaper, or whatever the word is. He's presenting to us the following video from Eretz Yisrael. He's now in Bavel. He brings us a video of what happened in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yochanan, in this video, made a statement, and he said, "Kofen Oso, we're going to force the Malveh to schlep to the Vad." Because the Lov insists on that. And Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar, who is Rabbi Yochanan's Talmud, says to him, Rabbi, how can you say such a thing? The Malv is now going to have to spend more money on the transportation than he spent on the Alvod with the money that he's trying to get back. That's ludicrous. Ela Kofano, so we should force the Lover to accept a local judgment. We live in the same, you know, Shchuna, we're here in the same neighborhood. That's where it will be. Itmar Nami, we have also the same kind of transmission by the name of a different Chacham. In this case, it's Rav Safra, and he says Shneim Shenisatzmu Bidin. Nisatzmu means they're getting tough one on the other. Each one is being rough. Echad Omer Nodin Kan, V'Echad Omer Neilich Mok. You know, it sounds like it's just whatever you say. I'm going to say the opposite. You're going to say let's judge it here. I'm going to say, let's go to the Makar of Vlad. Is Kofen Oso Vidan V'Iro? Which sounds like the other guy, and it, again, he doesn't seem to specify which one it is, but the one who says, let's schlep to the base Vlad, to the Makar of Vlad, no, we're going to force him to stay locally. So I have a footnote here. He says the following. This is Rav Mor. He says, Kasher shneim darim b'makom echad. They both live in the same area. And therefore, kofen oso vidan de'iro. There's no reason and no right to schlep him out of the city. We're both local. Kasher him dorim b'shnei makomos is then holech achar nitba. It all depends on what the nitba says, because there's no longer a claim, hey, let's do it locally, because we don't live in the same town. Okay, then, so this is where we're going to stop for today, and I'll wish everyone a good Shabbos, and hopefully we'll be able to finish. This is a really challenging sugya to try to figure out. It's very important, like, who has the final rights to say, well, I don't want to stay local. You know, I want to judge a judgment in a higher court.
If you're ignoring,
I'm just going to open up this door, because I'm supposed to fill in for Rabbi Myers. Oh, thanks.
If you ignore who's the chai and who's the other of that, right. Rav Safra seems to be agreeing with Rav Elazar that you force the one who wants to travel to stay local.
Correct.
That seems to be the
but with the following proviso, because they're both local. If they're not both local, then we go back to Rav Yochanan, who says that the lov is in the driver's seat. We could say, "I'm the nitbam, I'm the defendant. I don't want to stand court here. I want you to go. And you want to? You have a claim against me."